concept which everyone who's practicing needs to be familiar with and needs to apply in their practice, and that is the concept of reviewing where they are on the path. Not necessarily reviewing on the path whether they've become enlightened yet, but in terms of the different aspects of practice which are so clearly laid out by the Buddha, each of us needs to take responsibility for being aware of what we're focusing on in our practice, what we're trying to cultivate in our practice, what we should be doing in our practice, and to have some idea of where we've come to, what we've gained and what we've learned. And I'd like to support this idea of reviewing with a refrain that comes across in the course of the sutta as we read it. That is that we need to be aware of what we're doing and how far we've progressed. And this comes directly from the Buddha's first sermon on the Four Noble Truths, when he said that the first noble truth needs to be understood, the noble truth of suffering, and that then we need to abandon the second noble truth, the cause of suffering, not to abandon the noble truth, but to abandon the craving, which is the cause of suffering. We need to abandon that. We need to realize the third noble truth, which is Nibbana, and we need to develop the fourth noble truth, which is the Noble Eightfold Path. And this scheme of understanding what it is that we're dealing with, and then understanding what it is that's underlying it that we need to abandon, and then what we need to realize, and how we realize this through developing the practices given by the Buddha in the Noble Eightfold Path. This is a very good way of understanding what reviewing is about and what is involved in reviewing our practice. Do we understand what we're supposed to be doing? Do we understand where we're coming from? Do we understand what is the cause of our suffering, what propels us to take up this path? And then what are we struggling with as we go along? And so if we keep that in mind, we will see that this kind of phraseology of abandoning, of understanding, of developing, that comes up again and again in the sutta. And also the other factor that comes up again in the sutta, and which is a simplification, if you like, of that whole framework laid out in the Four Noble Truths, is the idea that we have to identify what is unwholesome and abandon it, and we have to identify what is wholesome and develop it. And we don't just abandon and think that's enough. We have to actively develop good qualities. And we don't just develop good qualities to counteract the bad qualities that we see. We have to be proactive in developing these wholesome qualities. And this twofold way of looking at it, abandoning what needs to abandon and developing what needs to develop, this also comes out in the course of the sutta. So the concept of reviewing is the first reason for taking up the study of this sutta. And the second reason for taking it up is because in the course of the sutta, the Buddha gives a very clear picture of what needs to be developed. And in terms of the factors of enlightenment and the various classes of practices we need to do, as we see as we go through the sutta, he enumerates those. So we have no cause to be concerned about what am I supposed to be doing? What was that that I'm supposed to do in order to get my mindfulness going, or what am I supposed to be doing with my concentration? It's all very clearly laid out. And so when we have something, an exposition like this, it's very helpful to know where it is, and we can just go back to it and consult it from time to time when we want to familiarize ourselves with what the whole of the path of practice contains, right up to enlightenment. And then as we go through the sutta, we'll see that one of the notes in the that Bhikkhu Bodhi has added, he mentions that the way that the Buddha has laid out the path of practice in this sutta is actually in a sequential way that shows what we need to develop in order to become able to access the jhanas, what we need to develop in order to become a stream winner, what we need to develop in order to become a non-returner, and what we need to develop all the way up to arahatship. So also to have that note from Bhikkhu Bodhi to refer to makes this sutta very accessible as an outline of the practice that we need to do. So although it is talking about the purification of alms food for a monastic, it's a very good teaching for all of us. And because it's a very short sutta, I thought it might be useful just to read through it first of all, so that you get the idea of this sequence and how it goes from the very basics right up to the fruit of enlightenment. So I'll just read through and then we'll come back and go through the sutta. Thus have I heard. On one occasion the Blessed One was living at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove, the squirrel's sanctuary. And this was the first monastery that was offered to the Buddha by King Bimbisara of Rajagaha after the Buddha's enlightenment. Then when it was evening, the Venerable Sariputta rose from meditation and went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, he sat down at one side. The Blessed One then said to him, Sariputta, your faculties are clear. The colour of your skin is pure and bright. What abiding do you often abide in now, Sariputta? And we can assume that the Buddha was just giving Venerable Sariputta the chance to say something, because the Buddha would know what was going on with Venerable Sariputta. Now, Venerable Sir, I often abide in voidness. Good, good, Sariputta. Now indeed you often abide in the abiding of a great man, for this is the abiding of a great man, namely voidness. And the commentary says that this is referring to the fruit of the path of arahatship. So in this, Sariputta is saying, in not so many words, that he is fully enlightened, and the Buddha is acknowledging this, that this is the abiding of all those who've become enlightened, whether they're the Pachaka Buddhas from the past, or the Buddha now, or those great disciples who are able to realize enlightenment. Would you like a copy of the sutta that we're doing? There's one there if you'd like. And because this is talking about something which I have no personal knowledge of, the fruit of the path of arahatship, I can just go by what it says in the scriptures and in the notes. And this abiding in voidness refers to abiding in nibbana, with nibbana as the object. And that voidness means the absence of greed, hatred and delusion. And because of the absence of greed, hatred and delusion, there is the absence of any conditioned phenomena there. Because the mind is free of greed, hatred and delusion, there's no push or pull out into the objects of the world. There's no desire, no aversion. And to be able to abide in this state is the fruit of being free completely of that push and pull. And not only of the push and pull of greed and hatred, but the sense of self, which takes one out into the world even when one is not really that concerned with the objects themselves, but wants to dabble because of our sense of self. And this voidness can only be attained by those who have realized the path of full enlightenment through cultivating both insight and serenity. So it's not a state that arises just out of concentration. It's not just a jhanic state that arises dependent on concentration. It's the fruit of insight, the fruit of wisdom, as well as the jhanic concentration that goes with that at the time of full enlightenment. So for those who've reached stage of full enlightenment, this is a state which they can access. It's not, it's distinct from the state of Nirodha Samapatti, which is where consciousness temporarily ceases, which is not available only to the Arahat. It's also available, so they say, to the non-returner, the Anagami, who has complete mastery over the eight jhanas. They also can attain the state where consciousness temporarily ceases. But to attain this state, the fruit of the Arahat path is only available to the fully enlightened one, to the Arahat. So this is the abiding of a great man, and you will see how this relates to the substance of the sutta. So, Sariputta, if a bhikkhu should wish, may I now often abide in voidness, that is, may I become enlightened, that's the other way of saying that, he should consider thus: on the path by which I went to the village for alms, or in the place where I wandered for alms, or on the path by which I returned from the alms round, was there any desire, lust, hate, delusion, or aversion in my mind regarding forms cognizable by the eye? And these are all synonyms. The desire and lust mean the same thing, hatred and aversion, the same sorts of things. Delusion, the delusion of a self. If by so reviewing he knows thus: on the path by which I went to the village for alms, or in the place where I wandered for alms, or on the path by which I returned from the alms round, there was desire, lust, hate, delusion, or aversion in my mind regarding forms cognizable by the eye, then he should make an effort to abandon those evil, unwholesome states. But if by reviewing he knows thus: on the path by which I went to the village for alms, and in the place where I wandered for alms, and on the path by which I returned from the alms round, there was no desire, lust, hate, delusion, or aversion in my mind regarding forms cognizable by the eye, then he can abide happy and glad, training day and night in wholesome states. So this is one of the points I made about this abandoning and developing. If one recognizes that unwholesome states have arisen, then one needs to abandon those. But if one recognizes that they haven't been triggered, and it may only be because one didn't see anything unpleasant, or one didn't come in contact with anything that one really likes, but one should still stay cultivating wholesome states. One shouldn't just rest on one's laurels or wait only until there's a challenge to start to do something. The cultivation of wholesome states has to be proactive. And in fact, as we do our practice, we see that it's really like going out to cut the enemy off at the pass before it has a chance to manifest. We develop the mind so that it is abiding in wholesome states, and the unwholesome states have less opportunity to enter the mind and take over because of that. Again, Sariputta, a bhikkhu should consider thus: on the path by which I went to the village for alms, or in the place where I wandered for alms, or on the path by which I returned from the alms round, was there any desire, lust, hate, delusion, or aversion in my mind regarding sounds cognizable by the ear, regarding odours cognizable by the nose, regarding flavours cognizable by the tongue, regarding tangibles cognizable by the body, regarding mind objects cognizable by the mind? And if by reviewing he knows thus: on the path by which I went to the village for alms, there was desire, lust, hate, delusion, or aversion in my mind regarding all of these objects, then he should make an effort to abandon those evil, unwholesome states. But if by reviewing he knows thus: on the path by which I went to the village for alms, there was no desire, lust, hate, or delusion, or aversion in my mind regarding mind objects cognizable through any of the senses, including the mind, then he can abide happy and glad, training day and night in wholesome states. So obviously one has to practice mindfulness when one is going out on alms round, to be aware of the impingement of sense objects on the mind. And so one of the supports for being mindful and being aware of sense impingement is to guard the senses so that one is forearmed as one goes on one's alms round. Because when the sense bases come in contact with objects that provoke lust or aversion, then the mind is engaged, and from that contact the perception and feeling automatically are triggered. And so one can not avoid being pushed and pulled around if one still has greed, hate and delusion in the mind. So one has to guard the senses to try to avoid or to minimize those impingements, or to select out the ones which are most detrimental to one's peace of mind. And so one has to be mindful and also guard the senses as one goes on one's alms round. Are there any questions of anything so far? Please stop me if there's anything that is not clear. So in reviewing, the Buddha now starts to take this whole experience apart. Again, Sariputta, a bhikkhu should consider thus: are the five chords of sensual pleasure abandoned in me? The five chords of sensual pleasure, I'll just give you the definition as we have it here many times in the suttas. Ananda, this is a time when the Buddha was talking to Ananda. There are these five chords of sensual pleasure. What five? Forms cognizable by the eye that are wished for, desired, agreeable and likeable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. Sounds cognizable by the ear, odours cognizable by the nose, flavours cognizable by the tongue, tangibles cognizable by the body, which are wished for, desired, agreeable, likeable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. These are the five chords of sensual pleasure. So we have not just the sense base and not just the object, but the desire in the mind, the lust in the mind, the attachment in the mind that binds us to those objects That's why it's called the five chords of sensual pleasure. And the Buddha has also mentioned the mind and mind objects. And in this sutta in which I'm reading out this definition, the Buddha goes on to say, "Herein a bhikkhu should constantly review his own mind thus. Does any mental excitement concerning these five chords of sensual pleasure ever arise in me on any occasion?" If on reviewing his mind, the bhikkhu understands mental excitement concerning these five chords of sensual pleasure does arise in me on certain occasions, then he understands desire and lust for the five chords of sensual pleasure are unabandoned in me. In this way, he has full awareness of that. But if on reviewing his mind, the bhikkhu understands no mental excitement concerning these five chords of sensual pleasure arises in me on any occasion, then he understands desire and lust for the five chords of sensual pleasure are abandoned in me. In this way, he has full awareness of that. So it's not just in the moment when one is coming in contact with these objects that are provocative of lust. We have to review the situation and know which situations is the mind excited in, more likely to be excited in. What kinds of objects are more likely to incite the mind? In what context, whether it's the external environment or what's going on internally, is my mind more likely to be excited by something that I come in contact with? And when we talk about the five chords of sensual pleasure, we think about desire and lust, but we also know that aversion, hatred, is also something that is stimulated in us. It's also a form of mental excitement. And so just as we start to become familiar with the situations in which we're vulnerable to desire arising, we also need to become aware of the situations in which we're vulnerable to ill will or aversion becoming arising, because very often desire and the lack of fulfillment of that desire gives rise to aversion. And then we have jealousy, we have resentment, we have all of the states that evolve out of greed and hatred. And so part of our reviewing is, especially after we've been caught in a situation where we feel we've lost it, where we feel we haven't been able to keep a guard over our senses so that we didn't get caught, pulled in the first place, and then it's gone on from there and we've actually reacted with speech and behaviour which was incited by greed or hatred, we have to look back at that and see what can we learn from it? How can we guard ourselves and protect ourselves for the next time? So the reviewing is something which often comes after the event, but sometimes, and I've spoken to people recently, when they review situations where they feel they've failed, and that's the word they've used, they often don't want to revisit that situation because it brings up a sense of disappointment in themselves or aversion towards themselves that they didn't live up to their standards or their ideals. And I would like to just make it clear that that's not how we learn. We learn by looking back and using our mistakes or our difficulties to be the way we see what didn't work, and also maybe to see what did work, because very often when we don't even look back to revisit the situation, we fail to glean some of the helpful hints that we could glean from it and see, oh, well, at least I didn't lose it quite as badly as last time I was there. And then we don't give ourselves any credit. We don't see the benefit that we've gained from the practice. So reviewing encourages us to go back and look again and to see what we can learn from the situations for the next time. Now, in terms of what I was saying in the beginning about this outline which comes in the Four Noble Truths about having to understand the first noble truth, we have to understand what is suffering, that there is suffering. What is suffering? Where does suffering arise? And if we don't pay attention to our experience, we don't see where there's suffering in the five cords of sensual desire. And then we don't see why we should do anything about it, that it needs to be abandoned, that it needs to be dealt with. And we don't see how we can do it. And so when the Buddha talks about the five cords of sensual desire in other places, he talks about the danger in the five cords of sensual desire. And this is so that we see that they're suffering, that we don't think, well, as long as I can keep them under control, or my greed under control, or my aversion under control, or as long as I don't lose it too badly or too often, it's all right. We have to see that this is the cause of suffering, and this is what we have to understand. So the Buddha in an earlier sutta says, after he talks about the forms and the sounds and the flavours that are agreeable, desired, agreeable, likeable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust, and he says, now the pleasure and joy that arise dependent on these five cords of sensual pleasure are the gratification in the case of sensual pleasures. And what, bhikkhus, is the danger in the case of sensual pleasures? And then the Buddha goes through quite a long list of things that are the dangers. He talks about how, on account of the craft by which a clansman makes a living, and he goes through the various kinds of ways that one can make a living, checking or accounting or calculating, farming or trading, husbandry or archery or royal service or whatever craft it is, he has to face cold, he has to face heat, he is injured by contact with gadflies and mosquitoes, wind, sun, creeping things, he risks death by hunger and thirst. Now this is the danger in the case of sensual pleasures, a mass of suffering visible here and now, because it's wanting to pursue sensual pleasure that we have to go out to work. We have to go out to work to survive, but also because we want to have this or that. And the more that we want to have this and that, the more we have to go out to work. And even if someone works hard and gains property and has a successful life, then he experiences the pain and grief of protecting it. How shall neither kings nor thieves make off with my property, nor fire burn it, nor water sweep it away, or hateful heirs make off with it? And he weeps when he loses what he had. And so this is again the danger in sensual pleasures, that we can't keep them. They don't last as long as we do. And so, and the Buddha goes on to say, because of sensual pleasures, they're the source of the basis for quarrels, kings quarrelling with kings, nobles with nobles, Brahmins with Brahmins, child with mother, mother with father, etc., etc., etc. And these are the dangers in sensual pleasure. And the Buddha goes on to enumerate all sorts of things that arise out of the desire for sensual pleasures, and the dangers go not only for this life but for the kind of rebirth that we can give rise to because we're consumed with the pursuit of sensual pleasure. Now, unless we see the dangers in sensual pleasure, we're not going to be willing to undertake this path of practice. We're not going to see the reason for it, the usefulness of it. Now, apart from seeing the danger, we also have to see that there's an alternative. And the alternative is the pleasure that we derive from a life of goodness, So this is the blameless bliss that the Buddha talks about through cultivating virtue and living a good life, but also the happiness that comes from developing the mind in meditation. And the Buddha says that we can only remove the desire and the lust for sensual pleasures if we start to see not only their disadvantage, but also the advantage in what can be gained by not having them as the focus of our life, of our activity, of the way we spend our time. And again, this is this abandoning and developing. This is a common repeating phrase or theme throughout the whole of the path of practice. We abandon what isn't useful, but we're not going to be left with nothing. We're getting something in return. And that's what we have to realise, that we're actually going to become rich, but in another way, if we can see that these sensual pleasures are not the the true source of happiness in this life. They obviously contribute to our comfort and our physical well-being, but there are other things which can give even greater happiness. And so that's what we start to practice this path in order to attain those riches. So we see the danger, we understand, and then we work for abandoning in order to develop. So if the bhikkhu sees that the five cords of sensual pleasure are abandoned, then he can abide happy and glad, training in wholesome states day and night. And if they are not abandoned, then he should make an effort to abandon those five cords of sensual pleasure. And then in the next verse, again Sariputta, a bhikkhu should consider thus, are the five hindrances abandoned in me? If by reviewing he knows thus, the five hindrances are not abandoned in me, then he should make an effort to abandon those five hindrances. But if by reviewing he knows thus, the five hindrances are abandoned in me, then he should abide happy and glad, training day and night in wholesome states. Now, as the note in the back of the book and also on the paper that you have points out, that now we have this sequence of development. So the abandoning of the five cords of sensual pleasure is the preliminary step for developing the mind in meditation, developing the jhanas. And the abandoning of the five hindrances is the immediate antecedent to the attainment of the first jhana. So we have a sequence here. And just to go to the hindrances, for those of you who aren't familiar with the hindrances, I'll just read out the passage in which the Buddha outlines the hindrances and also gives similes so that we can understand again why it's useful to do this work. And this is talking about someone who's starting to meditate. On returning from his arms round after his meal, he sits down, folding his legs crosswise, setting his body erect, and establishing mindfulness before him. Abandoning covetousness for the world, he abides with a mind free from covetousness. He purifies his mind from covetousness. So covetousness here is a synonym for sensual desire, for greed. Abandoning ill will and hatred, he abides with a mind free from ill will, compassionate for the welfare of all living beings. He purifies his mind from ill will and hatred. Abandoning sloth and torpor, he abides free from sloth and torpor, percipient of light, mindful and fully aware. He purifies his mind from sloth and torpor. Abandoning restlessness and remorse, he abides unagitated, with a mind inwardly peaceful. He purifies his mind from restlessness and remorse. Abandoning doubt,
he abides, having gone beyond doubt, unperplexed about wholesome states, he purifies his mind from doubt. And then the Buddha gives some similes so that we can understand these more fully. Because suppose a man were to take a loan and undertake business, and his business were to succeed so that he could repay all the money of the old loan, and there would remain enough extra to maintain a wife. Then on considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. Or suppose a man were afflicted, suffering, and gravely ill, and his food would not agree with him, and his body had no strength. But later he would recover from the affliction, and his food would agree with him, and his body would regain strength. Then on considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. Or suppose a man were imprisoned in a prison house, but later he would be released from prison, safe and secure, with no loss to his property. Then on considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. Or suppose a man were a slave, not self-dependent, but dependent on others, unable to go where he wants, but later on he would be released from slavery, self-dependent, independent of others, a freed man, able to go where he wants. Then on considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. Or suppose a man with wealth and property were to enter a road across a desert, but later on he would cross over the desert safe and secure, with no loss to his property. Then on considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. So too, bhikkhus, when these five hindrances are unabandoned in himself, a bhikkhu sees them respectively as a debt, a disease, a prison house, slavery, and a road across a desert. But when he sees these five hindrances have been abandoned in himself, he sees that as freedom from debt, healthiness, release from prison, freedom from slavery, and a land of safety. So again, we have the wisdom aspect of understanding the detriment of these five hindrances and how beneficial it is to overcome them, not just in order to progress in meditation, but to be a free person. So if one is in debt to sensual desire, one is always chasing after something that is never fully paid for, because when one fulfills one's desire in this occasion, it doesn't end desire, it just leads to another desire, and so there's a new arising and a new having to act. And if one is bound up with ill will, then one is like someone who has an unhealthy liver and an unhealthy, you get stones in the bile duct, yes, because of ill will and anger. And if you have restlessness and worry and you can't be free to use your mind the way you want to, or if you're very tired and can't put your dull mind to what you want to do, it's like you're a slave or you're in prison. And if you're full of doubt, then you never get anywhere doing anything, because you can never summon up your energy and passion to do what needs to be done, because you always undermine yourself with doubt. And so one needs to see the dissatisfaction when the hindrances are present, and also how they come to be, what situations give rise to the hindrances, and how we can work to overcome them. And we need to review again and again to see what is our particular tendency, which of the hindrances is the one that we're most vulnerable to, in what circumstances do we find that they overwhelm us, what ones do we find that we have to meet again and again. And we can only know this if we look back at our own personal situation and our own way of practice. What do we do that feeds the hindrances? So, for example, if we are overcome by ill will, if we keep looking at the bad points of the people that we don't like, then certainly our ill will will be stirred up. Seeing the bad points in anything is a way of
triggering ill will. And so we have to become skillful about knowing that's what happens and not feeding that kind of behaviour. So then we have to know what is happening with our mind as we come in contact with objects that we don't like. We can start to notice how we always zero in on the parts we don't like, or the thing that we remember, the thing that they didn't do that they should have done, instead of seeing what they're doing right now. So we become more familiar with the way that the hindrances are given play in our life. And then we also recognize that we have to do something. So we have understood that this is a source of suffering, and we've understood that there needs to be something abandoned here. So we have again that understanding and abandoning. And again, Sariputta, a bhikkhu should consider thus: are the five aggregates affected by clinging fully understood by me? If by reviewing he knows thus, the five aggregates affected by clinging are not fully understood by me, then he should make an effort to fully understand these five aggregates affected by clinging. But if by reviewing he knows thus, the five aggregates affected by clinging are fully understood by me, then he can abide happy and glad, training day and night in wholesome states. The five aggregates affected by clinging are the aggregate of the body, the material aggregate, and then the four aggregates of the mind: the feeling aggregate, the perception aggregate, the consciousness, sense consciousness aggregate, and then the sankhara aggregate. And in terms of how the Buddha says that they need to be fully understood, I'll just read that passage and then I'll explain them in a little bit more detail for those who don't understand them or know them. These five aggregates affected by clinging, in regard to which a bhikkhu should abide contemplating the rise and fall thus: this is such is material form, such is its arising, such is disappearance, such is feeling, such its arising, such its disappearance, such is perception, such its arising, such its disappearance, such are formations, such their arising, such their disappearance, such is consciousness, such its arising, such its disappearance. So the five aggregates affected by clinging is really a way of dissecting this human being, me, I, us, you, what we take to be a self. And the first aspect of that is the physical form, whether it's its appearance or what it's made up of. We take this body to be me. And so one of the things that we start to become familiar with is the fact that this body is made up of parts, components. It isn't a whole thing, it isn't one thing. It's made up of all different bits and pieces, and all of those different pieces are integral to its functioning and to its well-being. And if any of those bits and pieces cease to work well, it affects the whole. We know that those bits and pieces need to be supported by things like food, water, air, in order for that material form to survive, and that this material form can be adversely affected if it is exposed to the cold or the heat, doesn't get food that it needs, if exposed to viruses or whatever. So we start to become aware of the fact that this material form, this body, which we take to be me, we take to be my property, and we take to have ownership over, is actually something which we don't have control over. We don't have ownership over. It's arisen according to causes and conditions. And that if we try to find out which is the central core of this body, which is the one thing that makes it me, as we take it apart and dissect it, as we analyse the parts that are in it, we can't find any one thing that can stand alone, independently, or that is unchanged and means that it's me. Likewise, when we talk about the other aggregates affected by clinging, this is the mental aggregates which make up the mind. The Buddha showed that there are different functions in the mind, which again we can identify with as me. So when we see something or hear something and we have a feeling about it, whether it's a pleasant or an unpleasant feeling, we very often take that to be me, my feeling. But if we start to analyse it, we can see that it also is conditioned by many different things, by our past experience of that thing, by our understanding of that thing, by the situation in which we are encountering it right now. So, for example, one example is the food that we like to eat that gives us a pleasant feeling. It will be different for all of us. And we may smell that food and may conjure up, ah, love that, I remember that when I was a child, or, oh, my mum makes great ones of those, or, oh, gee, I had that last time I was such and such. And there are lots of associations with it apart from the taste. But it conjures up a pleasant feeling and we think that's me. But it's something that's been conditioned. Pleasant and unpleasant feeling alike. So with the perception of that, whether we recognise it as food or whether we think that there's something that's wrong with this thing. So, for example, if we are familiar with durian fruit, for people who don't know it, when they first smell it and look at it, they think, oh, someone's left rotten something or other here. They don't know that what they're smelling and seeing is actually food because they haven't had that experience of it. And so perception is also conditioned. And then the consciousness that arises, that is whether we see it or hear it or smell it or taste it or touch it or think about it, is also conditioned by factors like whether there's enough light, whether there's many other sounds going on and that sound vibration is inaudible to us, all of those things, whether we're paying attention, that is also conditioned. And then our reaction to it, the sankhara, similarly is conditioned by our past experience. So the Buddha is, in this aspect, asking us to keep on reviewing our experience, what we take to be, I did this, I like that, I heard this, I'm going there, I'm enjoying this, all of the things that we I about, to start to look at them through the eye of Dharma. Start to look again in terms of what we've heard of the teaching and to review whether we took that experience rightly or not. If we're just following our old conditioning, the things that we like because we've always liked them. The things that we don't like because we've always felt that way. And to start to be able to take apart the experience in the moment, to recognize the feeling when it arises, that is pre-verbal, that is before the thought, the sankhara that arises, produced by that sight or sound and that feeling and that perception. This is what we need to do in order to say that we understand these five aggregates.
Sorry,
yes. The sankhara is the Pali word for mental formations or the productions of the mind, so what is produced, the reaction to whatever it is that we come in contact with. Now, the reaction, first of all, is just triggered automatically. It's a whole process that goes on, recognizing that thing from our past experience. But what we do with that now is the mental formation. So it includes choice, it includes will, it includes what we say or do as a result of the thing that we just have seen or heard or smelled. So it's not the past, it's what we do in the present, and this is where we make new karma. This is the point at which the new thing comes in. And with mindfulness and with training, even when old reactions come up, that is an unpleasant feeling, when we smell that durian, we have an unpleasant feeling, instead of saying, oh, get rid of that stupid stuff, and aversion comes up and we don't like it and we act on it, with practice we're mindful of the fact that this smell has produced an unpleasant feeling. It's that durian smell that we don't like, and we can just allow, we don't like it. We don't have to run off into, oh, get rid of it, ill will, and then acting on it. So that is the sankhara. So when we are becoming familiar with the five aggregates, we start to become aware of this process happening in each moment of our experience. But of course, for most of us, not each moment of our experience. We lose it, and then we very often benefit from reviewing what went on there. What was it that triggered that, and what was it that it triggered in terms of my past memory of it, how I felt last time? What's the difference between the feeling, the intensity of the feeling that's produced now, and the intensity of the feeling that I used to feel at that? So, for example, if we don't like things, we can notice in the past, ooh, we couldn't. And now we feel, oh, yeah, that's it. And it's, we notice, ah, there's a change. So we can start to see that this practice is benefiting us, because we're becoming less reactive to the things that we used to get overwhelmed by. So, is this class supposed to stop at 4 or 4:30? What time does the class stop? 4, okay. The class stops at 4, so we've only got a little bit of time to go. Okay, so now that I hope through what I've said so far, it's just given you the idea that in this sutta, we're very conveniently guided by the Buddha to look in the places where we can see what we're supposed to be doing in our practice, how we're doing it, and whether it's paying off. The actual doing of it, that's what we have to take away and practice. But now we come to the point where the Buddha outlines the actual tools that we're developing in order to cultivate this path. And so I'll just read through them. Again, Sariputta, a bhikkhu should consider thus, are the four foundations of mindfulness developed in me? Are the four right kinds of striving developed in me? The four bases of spiritual power developed in me? The five powers developed in me? The seven enlightenment factors developed in me? The Noble Eightfold Path developed in me? Is serenity and insight developed in me? Now, all of these things are leading to the development, or are the development of insight and the development of serenity. These are the things which actually give rise to serenity and insight if we cultivate them. So the four foundations of mindfulness, the four places where we need to be paying attention to our body, the movements of the body, the actions of the body, the feelings, feelings in the body, feelings in the mind, so both the mental aspect of that pleasant or unpleasant experience, plus the way that plays itself out in our body. That's the second foundation of mindfulness. The state of the mind that is observing, so whether the mind is full of lust or full of love, full of ill will, full of feeling very mean and contracted, the kind of mind that we're using when we are trying to pay attention. So sometimes when we sit down to meditate, we'll notice that our mind is very speedy. And so we'll know, oh, with a speedy mind, this is what I need to do if I want to settle the mind. Sometimes the mind is very dull, and we know, well, we have to do certain things to try and lighten up the mind. So that is the third foundation. And then the fourth foundation of mindfulness, the dharmas in the mind, are many of the objects that we can know with our consciousness. So the five hindrances, the four noble truths, things that the mind can actually know. So the body, the feelings that are produced through contact, the quality of the mind that is doing the knowing, and then the objects that the mind can know. That's the four foundations of mindfulness. The four kinds of striving are the four right efforts, the effort to abandon unwholesome states when they've arisen and not to allow them in the first place, to develop and cultivate wholesome states, and when they are present in the mind, to make them grow. The four bases for spiritual power, the iddhipadas, these are another way of approaching particularly the development of concentration. The chanda iddhipada is to have the zeal and the desire to do this work and to develop the path of practice. The energy iddhipada is to apply one's energy in order to accomplish what one sets out to do, what one's goal is. The citta iddhipada is to apply the mind to what one needs to do in order to accomplish the task. This is all for developing the mind, particularly in concentration. And then the vimansa iddhipada is to use that concentrated, developed mind to investigate one's experience. Now, you'll find that these qualities which the Buddha points us to again and again in this list of the tools that we need to develop, the practices we need to undertake, they all cross over. They interconnect with each other again and again. So the iddhipadas, or the four bases of spiritual power, we find them similar sorts of things in the five spiritual powers. Sorry, the five spiritual faculties, the indriyas, which become the five spiritual powers at the point of stream entry. So these are faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Faith is an energizing quality which gives us a goal out of our confidence in our trust that this is the way to go. So it corresponds to the zeal or the chanda in the four roads to success, the four iddhipadas. The energy that we need to generate comes from having that zeal, that faith, that confidence. And then we need to generate that energy by putting it to work, by becoming more mindful. And this is where we cross over to the four foundations of mindfulness. What should we become mindful of? The four foundations of mindfulness. And we need to become mindful not just when we're in the middle of something, but with reviewing, we look at the thing afterwards. So mindful of what went on before, so we can review it and learn from it. Concentration and wisdom, this is another way of saying serenity and insight. And concentration is always the four jhanas, the four deep absorptions, which can only be accessed when we have turned away from seeking our satisfaction through indulging in sensual pleasure, through the five cords of sensual pleasure. Not that we turn away from them completely all at once, but we have to see that these are a second-rate way of finding pleasure. And the Buddha says in one of the suttas, which I haven't had time for you to read for you, which he says, if you think that sensual pleasures through seeing or hearing or smelling or tasting or touching are the best pleasures that you can have in the world, then I'm going to differ with you, because I know a pleasure which is much better. And then he goes on to talk about the pleasure that comes through the mind, through meditation. So when we see the unsatisfactoriness in sensual pleasure, when we see the suffering, we've understood the first noble truth. We realize the second noble truth of having to abandon craving, which underpins that first noble truth. Then we start to practice to cultivate what needs to be cultivated in order to develop the mind in serenity and wisdom. So we need to be able to abandon the five hindrances. And those five hindrances push us around while ever we're still trying to find our satisfaction out there in the world. Once we've seen that that's not possible, then we challenge the hindrances and gradually we weaken them and overcome them. And this is the four right efforts applied, where we abandon what needs to abandon and we develop their counterpoint, the wholesome qualities. And we substitute the wholesome qualities for the unwholesome. But we don't just wait till we're challenged by the unwholesome. We are proactive. We actively go out to cultivate what is good. So keeping the precepts, undertaking to keep the precepts, is being proactive and then doing what needs to be done to keep them. We only do it when we see that it's useful. We have faith that it's useful, and then we have zeal that we want to accomplish this goal. See how they all go together. And I'm sorry I have to rush through, but there's 37 of these. Okay. Oh, well, that's good. I don't know whether people have to go, so if you have to go, please feel free to. So the point is that this list which the Buddha outlines are not things which exist in isolation from each other. They all interconnect, and when we start to develop one and understand what we're doing, then we see the connection to the next. So when we have faith in the Buddha's teaching and we also have an idea that it's possible to accomplish this path if we follow the directions, then that will support the arising of chanda idipada, the zeal to do it, because we don't get zeal to do it if we think, well, I can't do it, I'm hopeless, or others can do it but not me, or oh, they could do it in the past but you can't do it now. But when the faith arises that this is a path which is present here and now, the results can be seen here and now, they happen when you do them, you get the result, then that generates the intense desire to go for it. So all of these things are interconnected. And as the Buddha is saying, what we need to do is to ask ourselves, review, have these things been developed in me? Are they present in me? And it's not a judgment of, oh, gee, they're not. It's, oh, they're not. So what do I need to do to develop them? Or if they are, to what extent are they developed in me? To what extent can I see progress? To what extent do I understand more clearly what I need to do? And this reviewing helps us to continually be, if you like, right at the coalface, right where we need to be doing the work, rather than just floating along hoping that somehow it'll all happen to us. Now, in the commentary at the back, written by Bhikkhu Bodhi, it says, "The abandoning of the five cords of sensual pleasure is the preliminary step for developing the jhanas, and the abandoning of the five hindrances is the immediate antecedent to the attainment of the first jhana. The full understanding of the five aggregates indicates the insight wisdom necessary to attain the path of stream entry. And the sections on the 37 requisites of enlightenment, the cultivation of the factors needed to arrive at the intermediate states of sanctity." So if we understand the five aggregates fully, then we come to the point of stream entry. The stream enterer understands that what we take to be a self is a conglomerate, a thing that is composed of various ingredients that has no self-existing, independent, permanent core to it, whether it's this body or this mind, or the body and the mind in interaction together. So this Sakkaya Ditti, this view of ourselves as a self-existing entity, this is when one sees through the five aggregates, that view is overcome. So again, we see this abandoning of the wrong view and the arising, the developing of what needs to be developed, that is the true understanding of these five aggregates. Once one has attained stream winning, one has absolute faith and confidence in the Buddha's teaching. So then the faith which one started with in terms of the five spiritual faculties, the indriyas, I said there was faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration and wisdom, that faith then becomes absolutely unshakable. And so we say then that those spiritual faculties or indriyas become the five spiritual powers or balas. The faith which was unshakable, you know for sure that the Buddha's teaching is right. And so that, if, as you can imagine, strengthens your desire to accomplish what can be accomplished. So the application of energy, you don't have to talk yourself into it anymore. It really is just there with you. And the fruits of this path, you see the benefits to be gained, they themselves inspire you to keep going. And with that inspiration, it's easier to be mindful. One can be mindful for longer stretches of time. One can be aware of what's going on mentally, defilements that are present and when they're not present, what produces them and what allows them to cease. So one starts to develop wisdom, a greater understanding of the causes of one's suffering, and also because one has this experience of the truth of the teaching, a far greater degree of mental peace, mental serenity, which allows one to hopefully improve one's meditation, enjoy the bliss, the peace of the meditation more easily. So these five spiritual faculties, if you like, are turned up a notch when they become the five spiritual powers. And the seven enlightenment factors. Again, we're talking about crossover of things. The first of the enlightenment factors is the investigation of dharmas. The investigation of dharmas means that one is investigating one's experience as one goes along, but one is also checking one's experience against the teaching. One is looking to see what is my experience telling me about the teaching. Is the teaching true as I'm experiencing it in my life? Is it helping me to understand myself and my reactions? Mindfulness is the next factor. So in order to be on the ball, we have to be mindful. Energy is also in the seven factors of enlightenment. We need to apply our energy in order to do the work. So you see a crossover from the other factors of enlightenment that we're talking about. Sorry, the requisites for enlightenment. And then as we progress, sorry. Yes.
So I know the Buddha himself said that to try out and see if his teachings are sound.
Yes.
But you said the word right, and I just have a problem with that because, I mean, how do you know something's right? Obviously, that's a relative. It has to be relative, isn't it? Okay.
If it's true for you, and also what is the result of doing it. If it brings more suffering, then there's something wrong.
No result.
That's right. Yeah. So in investigating, each of us will be drawn to particular aspects of our experience to investigate it, and things that we think are fine, that we've got no problem with, that they're not a question about should I be doing this or not, yeah. We won't investigate those. Basically, our suffering is what inspires us to look for an answer to something. The parts of our life where we're content or happy or we feel we've got the answers, we rarely go there and investigate that. So we'd say, okay, that's all right. Is that getting to what you're meaning?
Yeah, sort of. It's like there's a right with a capital R and a small r. You don't know what's actually right. It's like more of a relative truth.
Okay. Yes. Well, it will also always be relative also because we have this distorted perception. We see everything through the viewfinder of self. So it will only be relative up until the time of enlightenment. Yeah. If we keep producing the conditions, yes, it's a natural process. And the way that we know we're not enlightened is if we're still suffering. Perfection of view. So it's really, in terms of right view, we're talking about there's the mundane right view, which is where we're at as we progress and start to get a hold on the teaching and understand bits and pieces. And then there's the perfected view, which is the right view with a capital, which is the Arahat has, the fully enlightened one has. So we're moving towards that, but it's always only partial. That's yes. Yes.
I've heard you saying right in the way of right. That you have to face that everything is the teaching is right.
Yes. So the unshakable confidence in the Buddha that arises, it is one of the results of seeing the truth of the teaching for oneself, tasting Nibbana for oneself. When one becomes a stream winner. So at that point, the experience of Nibbana and the insight into the teaching is experiential. It's not coming from what you've heard from another. It's what you experience yourself. And with that experience is not only the experience, but the understanding of the experience. And so then you are totally convinced. So in that way you would say that the unshakable faith which arises at that time would be right faith. I just made it up. But just putting the two together. So but even someone who's a stream winner and who's got an understanding that what the Buddha says is true won't have the full picture still and won't be able to live that out in every moment of their life because they've still got ignorance. They've still got delusion. So their old conditioning will still very often push them along until they stop and realise what I'm thinking or taking to be real is just, I know it's not like that at all. So old perceptions, old feelings will still arise, and then there's the recognition that's not really an accurate reflection of reality. What I'm making of that is not a reflection of reality. That's what the wisdom of stream entry helps one to see. Yes. Okay, well, let's get on. So basically, with all of these things, they're all contributing to the development of serenity and insight. And if you remember at the beginning, I said that this, the fruit of arahatship, this void the abiding in voidness, which Venerable Sariputta said that was his most usual abiding now, and the Buddha says it's the abiding of a great man or great woman, a person who's practicing this path, that has to be the fruit of both serenity and insight. It isn't just the fruit of concentration. It has to be developed with both concentration and insight. And so all of these things, by reviewing, has to ask, are serenity and insight developed in me? And if by reviewing he knows serenity and insight are not developed in me, then he should make effort to develop them. And if by reviewing he knows thus serenity and insight are developed in me, then he can abide happy and glad, training day and night in wholesome states. And I actually forgot, I didn't mention the other of the seven factors of enlightenment. The pity, the pasadi, the joy and the tranquility, they refer to the concentration or serenity states of mind. In the seven factors of enlightenment, we first of all had the mindfulness, the energy and the investigation. So they're all to do with, their emphasis is on insight. But the piti and the joy and the tranquility, they are, and concentration, which is the next one, they are to do with the development of the mind in serenity. And then the outcome is equanimity. And equanimity arises ultimately as a result of both calm and insight, not just the keeping a balanced mind because you've got a buoyant mind through concentration, but keeping a balanced mind because you've got a wise mind. You know things as they really are. So, as I said, many of the aspects or the factors or the tools that we have to develop, they're saying the same thing and they're pointing in the same direction towards the cultivation of serenity and insight. Again, Sariputta, a bhikkhu should consider thus, are true knowledge and deliverance realized by me? And if by reviewing he knows thus, true knowledge and deliverance are not realized by me, then he should make an effort to realize true knowledge and deliverance. But if by reviewing he knows thus, true knowledge and deliverance are realized by me, then he can abide happy and glad, training day and night in wholesome states. So, how does one know whether true knowledge and deliverance, the absence of greed, hatred and delusion? That is how one knows. If one still is suffering, one knows that true knowledge and deliverance hasn't been realized. And even if one has realized those states and has been delivered, then one still trains in wholesomeness, in wholesome states day and night. And I just was listening to a talk from Achan Brahm recently when he mentioned that when he was in Thailand as a monk, that at one stage one of the bhikkhus in the monastery declared his enlightenment to Achan Chah. And Achan Chah's instructions to that monk was that now he had to continue to train in developing loving kindness, because that was his duty now, to spread loving kindness to the world. And so if we think at the end, when there's we've done all the we've become enlightened and there's nothing more to do, there's nothing more to do in order to be free of suffering for ourselves, but there's something more to be done in terms of offering to the world. And that's why this says he can abide happy and glad, training day and night in wholesome states. And even if one has attained arahatship, if one hasn't developed all of the meditative absorptions, then one can go back and train in developing all of those states, and one can access even different pleasant abidings apart from the fruit of arahatship. So that is what in the commentary is said is although the arahat who has fully realized true knowledge and deliverance has no need for further training, he continues to cultivate serenity and insight in order to enter the bliss of the jhanas, the fruition attainment of arahatship, and the cessation of perception and feeling. That was the nirodha, which I talked about earlier. So to just recap, what it says again in the commentary here is that the full understanding of the five aggregates indicates the insight wisdom necessary to attain the path of stream entry, and the sections on the 37 requisites of enlightenment, the cultivation of the factors needed to arrive at the intermediate stages of sanctity, that is, as the once-returner or the non-returner, especially with the overcoming of greed and hatred at the non-returner level. The section on serenity and insight, though applicable to all stages, can be seen as fully actualized by the non-returner striving for arahantship. Finally, the section on true knowledge and deliverance signifies the attainment of path and fruit of arahatship. So the Buddha said at the beginning, if any bhikkhu, and that means anyone who's practicing, wants to be able to abide in the abiding of the great man, namely voidness, this is what they need to do. They need to follow this path, and then while they're following the path, they need to constantly review so that they see what needs to be abandoned and what needs to be developed, and to understand what has been understood and what needs to be further understood. So Sariputta, whatever recluses and Brahmins in the past have purified their alms food have all done so by repeatedly reviewing thus. Whatever recluses and Brahmins in the future will purify their alms food will all do so by repeatedly reviewing thus. Whatever recluses and Brahmins in the present are purifying their alms food are all doing so by repeatedly reviewing thus. Therefore, Sariputta, you should train thus. We will purify our alms food by repeatedly reviewing thus. That is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Sariputta was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So, that's the end of the sutta. Please, any questions? Yes, so that the next one is piti or joy. The next one is tranquility. The next one is concentration. And the next one is equanimity. So those are to do with the serenity of the mind. And then the equanimity is initially based on serenity, but then once one is on the path with wisdom, then it is also supported by wisdom and ultimately is the result of wisdom. Yes. Yes. Yeah, the four foundations of mindfulness, which I've got somewhere here. The first is the body, so becoming aware of the body as material form and that it is composed of bits and pieces, various components, that it exists dependent on causes and conditions like food, that it's subject to disintegration and harm, even if it doesn't get affected by the weather or whatever, it will eventually disintegrate. So that's the first one, the body. Then the four, the feeling, which is the mental feeling of pleasant or unpleasant or neither, that is produced when we come in contact with something, seeing something or hearing something, but also the feeling as it's experienced in the body, which is a pleasant or unpleasant sensations in the body. So that's the feeling, that's the second aggregate. The second foundation. The third foundation is the mind, that's the citta. So that's what kind of mind, what quality of mind, what tone or mood or colour of mind are we bringing to the practice, whether it's in our daily life. Do we have a peaceful mind or a disturbed mind? Do we have a mind that's angry, or do we have a mind that's friendly? Do we have a mind that's lustful, or a mind that's content? Is the mind very contracted or expanded? That sort of thing. And then the last one is the objects that the mind can know, and that includes everything. It includes the aggregates and all the things that we know through consciousness, but also particular things like the five hindrances and the four noble truths. So it's what the mind can know. So if we're being mindful and paying attention, they're the four things we can pay attention to. Not all at once, but usually we take one and make it our main object. So it might be the body, watching the body, being with the body, being with the movements of the body, just as an observer, enough to know this is what the body's like, with feeling, just enough to know this is what feeling is like, this is what the mind is like, the moods of the mind. Well, that's 1.5 hours. So I think that's enough. So thank you very much. I hope you can take this away and use it in your practice. Thank you for coming.